It is now my privilege to introduce tonight's honorary 10-minute speaker. Please help me offer a warm welcome for Justin R. of Visalia.
Good evening. I'm Justin, and I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Bill, for asking me to speak. I didn't really know what I was going to say, and so I'll just start out. When you only have 10 minutes, it's like, how much of your drunkalog can you get in? But at the same time, I probably should qualify. I'm an alcoholic, so there's that. I drank, and I never really understood or identified that, you know, my drinking was a problem or that it was in excess. It just felt natural, and it felt right to be moving at the speed that I wanted to move at. And that speed just seemed to be faster than, what others felt comfortable. And to just kind of fast forward, my life just constantly, I kept trying to battle to make my life better, and my life constantly just seemed to, slowly get worse in ways while at the same time seemingly getting better. So, I'm 21. I'm in my first AA meeting, and my parents have my grandmother take me there, and I just copped a resentment because no one made a big deal about the fact that I was 21, and they should, because I'm so young, and so I left. And then by 25, I'm graduating college, and I'm being hauled off to a rehab clinic in Los Angeles, and that's where I lived for the next 8 months, and that ended with me drinking. And then by the time I was 29, things just got to be so bad that my family said that I couldn't be a part of their lives anymore unless I got some help. And my friends, there were three different houses that I was banned from going over to. They stopped letting me come over. People stopped answering my phone calls. Two drug dealers actually blocked my phone number. And this is an AA program, but I won't get into it. But that's not a good sign when even drug dealers won't pick up your call. So, at that point, I was broken enough to decide that I was going to go, live on the streets. And that was my big plan. It's like, all right, I'm going to sell off the rest of what I have, to give me a little money. And then that's what I'm going to start doing is living, on the streets. Right as those plans started to unfold and that, my next move was made, my uncle, took me to an AA meeting. It was 2 days before Christmas, and it was an hour away in Fresno. And as we drove up there, it was in his 1980s, creepy van that the windows didn't roll down, and the lights would turn off every couple of minutes. So we're driving down the freeway, and just all of a sudden it'd be pitch black on the freeway. There's no one else on the road. It's just pitch black, and you have to jiggle the wires, and then the lights would flip back on. And but as we drove up there, he started telling me about his life and where his life took him, and we're smoking cigarettes, hot boxing his car with cigarettes, it was strange because for the first time in a long time I felt safe, and I'd forgotten what that felt like to feel comforted. And and he told me about his life, and he said, you're lucky that there's a meeting in Fresno. If not, we'd be driving down to Los Angeles right now. And he said, I want to show you just how serious about my sobriety I am, that I'm willing to go to any lengths to stay sober. And that was the process for me, was just learning how to, a day at a time, just kind of hold on for dear life. And as things progressed, it just became a hell of a lot easier. The people in AA made me feel welcomed and treated me with kindness. They told me to keep coming back. It was just great. at the beginning, I'd step out in the middle of the meeting and, you know, get my cigarette fixed, and I'd be, you know, down in coffee like crazy, and they had, you know, little sweets on the tables, and it was just, it became something that I couldn't wait for. I couldn't wait to get to the next AA meeting. And still to this day, I've never experienced anything like it. I've never been in a place where people who I have maybe nothing in common with, who come from a completely different walk of life, who, they might not even speak the same language as me. And yet, when you break it down, when we connect, we find that there's something that just unites us. And it's absolutely incredible that I can walk into a place and know that I belong and not be judged for it. I realized I was speaking and that was at about 6:20. And so then I'm like rushing to eat dinner and, you know, get going. And I'm like, shoveling food in my mouth. And it's like, oh man, whether or not this goes well, whether or not I connect, it doesn't matter. Whether it's good or whether it's bad, it doesn't matter because I'm sober and I am able to wake up sober and go to sleep sober. And my life has gotten better every day, every month, every year. And it's really not of my own doing other than just doing some simple things. I recognize just how, in the times when I fall short, I want to recognize that. I want to admit it. I want to work on my faults. I want to work on myself, and I have the power to do so because I'm sober. I have the power to connect to people. I can look people in the eyes today, which was something I didn't know if I'd ever be able to do that. I'm comfortable in my own skin. I didn't know if I'd ever progress to that point in sobriety where I'd be comfortable in my own skin, where I could look people in the eyes, where I could have a conversation that wasn't about me, where I could actually let people talk during a conversation. I remember the first time I did that, I was actually quite impressed with myself that I didn't say a single thing while the other person was talking. It's simple things. I've been able to restore the relationships with my family. I've been able to develop new relationships. My life sucked when I got here. I had nothing. I absolutely had nothing. And yet I was sober, and that was enough. That was enough. And I knew as long as I stayed sober, it was going to be worth it to wake up and try it again the next day. And so that's why I'm here. It's for me to stay sober, but if it begins and ends with me, then I'm not doing enough. It has to be about something more. And whatever that is, I don't know, but I'm willing to just say, okay, God, here you go. This is all I got. This is what I have to work with. I'm going to just, leave it all in your hands and just try and put one foot in front of the other. I still those defects of character will always be with me, but I'm working on them daily, and that's where I'm at. I'm just grateful. I'm grateful to be able to wake up sober for another day. So thank you, Bill, for asking me to speak. I probably have not gone 10 minutes, but hopefully that was long enough, and I'm looking forward to the next speaker. So thanks.
Thank you, Justin, for sharing your story, man. We appreciate it. It is now my privilege to introduce tonight's main speaker. Please help me offer a warm Tulare County welcome all the way from Pasadena to our speaker tonight, Kat Kinna S.
Thank you, Les. Hi, everybody. I'm Kenna Fukuyama, and I'm an alcoholic. And first, I apologize that I'm sitting here in the dark. Between teaching from home and meetings, I'm on Zoom like 35, 40 hours a week, and it just scrambles my brain and fries my eyeballs. And I have a little lamp I usually use, but I broke it today. So here I am. And thank you so much for inviting me. Thank you, Bill. I know we've tried to connect a couple times, and here we are. We did it at last. So I appreciate the invitation. Thank you, Justin, for your 10 minutes. And I also, in addition to, you know, the message that Justin carried tonight, I want to thank this group for the heavy message that you carried with the service commitments and the announcements that were made, right? It just reminds me how well AA works, and there's lots of ways that we carry the message, and it's oftentimes just, you know, watching what you do, right? And if you're new and looking for a home group and you live in Tulare County, I would recommend this one because it obviously has love and service right at the heart of it. That is not just my opinion. It's what I witnessed here tonight. And my sobriety date is September 24th, 1985. And no, I don't have any bad news about my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Definitely not. I've been very, very blessed. But that being said, this is a rough month for me, March. And the last few years have been a bit rough for me. And and, you know, I wish I could tell you a different story tonight. Sometimes I wasn't speaking for about a year, and when I started again, it feels a little bit like walking the plank sometimes, just like I don't want to tell you this story, but it's my story to tell. So, and just to kind of put that in context, March 1st of 2017, I was with my husband at my father-in-law's bedside when he passed away, and 28 days after that, I was at my husband's bedside in our home when he passed away. And 7 days after that, I was at my dad's bedside when he passed away. And 7 days after that, we put our dog down, who'd been my husband's companion in his illness. And that July, my husband's one of his closest friends who'd been in our wedding passed away suddenly. And then that fall, I went to Minnesota to eulogize my oldest and dearest friend, Anne, who had passed away. And that's a lot of loss in a short period of time. That doesn't make me special or tragic or a victim. It makes me in the game. Alcoholics Anonymous has made me a daughter, a wife, a daughter-in-law, a friend. It's given me the ability to have long-standing relationships. And, you know, that's baked into the cake. It's the portion of every human life that when you love and connect, that there's loss. And it doesn't mean I have to like it, though. And you know, so it's been a little rough. And, of course, I know I'm not alone, and I know that there's people here tonight who, you know, who certainly we all are carrying something, right? And that's my something right now. I grew up in Santa Cruz and up north on the Monterey Bay there. You guys know where Santa Cruz is. And lots of alcoholism in my family. My great-grandfather, my dad's side of the family's all from Humboldt County. My great-grandfather spent the last years of his life in a mental institution. He'd been committed as a wet brain. My grandfather, his son, got and stayed sober sometime in the 1940s in Eureka. And AA wasn't even a decade old. My grandfather's big book has no traditions in them because they hadn't been written yet. And I don't know, I'd love to get into their archives sometime and see how it got to that relatively small town, you know, up in the Redwoods, so early in the history of AA, but it did. And my grandfather got the message, and he carried that message to me. He died when I was 14, when I was just starting to drink. But my father, who never found his way here, he moved out and left my mom, the librarian, with these four children. I'm the youngest of those four kids. He didn't go far. He moved in down the street with another woman and her kids. And growing up in that alcoholic home, you know, it wasn't like the worst alcoholic home. Definitely not. But, you know, we were like, our Christmas lights stayed up all year, right? My dad was going to paint the house, and he got it like half sanded one weekend, and then it just stayed that way till we moved, you know. And sometimes he'd be in jail, or sometimes the police would bring him home, you know, that we were never very popular in the neighborhood. occasionally he'd be, you know, I remember one morning coming out, probably a Sunday morning, his jacket was over the kitchen chair and it was soaked in blood, and just that heavy silence in an alcoholic home. The word safety was used here tonight, and absolutely AA is the safest place I know. Cause being, you know, as a kid in active alcoholism, in the family. And I love that you, have your Al-Anon member here, tonight sharing, that gracious invitation to our sister program. But, you know, and then like creeping into my parents' bedroom and there was my dad like all beat up and bandaged up and like not a word was said, right? Just that heavy, heavy silence. I remember one time the glass man had been there for like the third time in a week to fix yet another broken window. And when he was leaving, he stuck his head back in the front door and said to my mom, "Lady, you're the captain of a strange ship." And that kind of, that's what it was like at 422 Rigg Street in Santa Cruz. And, my grandfather though, so when my dad left, my grandfather, I imagine, you know, because he was sober, we didn't lose that house. He stepped up and kind of became the kind of father figure that my dad couldn't be and that he probably couldn't be to my dad. Perhaps he was making living amends, but, you know, he paid, helped my mom make the mortgage payments, and he paid the tuition at the Catholic school that we went to, and put braces on our teeth. And so you were working in my life before I ever even drank or knew that I needed you or even that you existed. Now, I knew that my grandfather used to be like my dad and wasn't anymore, and there was something special about him, and it's clear to me now what it was. It was Alcoholics Anonymous is what I was looking at. I love Catholic school. I don't think I'm recovering from that experience, and I recognize that was not many people's experience. I happen to have a very positive one. The priests and the nuns in my parish were very good examples of love and service, and I had a good connection with that Catholic God as a kid. It was a real anchor in my life, especially I think because home was so chaotic. So that parish and that school and going to Mass on Sundays and that community and the deep roots that we had there, was just a real safe spot for me. I mention that because that was one of the first things that had to go when I started to take the actions of an alcoholic woman. I could not reconcile the things I was doing with the tenets of my faith, and I had to turn my back on the most comforting thing that I knew, which was the connection with the God and my understanding. And I'm so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous for helping me find a way back to that. And I can tell you that the morning after my eighth grade graduation, I mentioned I'm the youngest of four kids. My mom's at the kitchen table. I'd been real active in that school. She had my diploma, and I'd won some little pins and stuff. And I was on my way to the Catholic high school had closed, and so I was on my way to public school. And she had gone to that school for 13 years, and her mother had gone there, and her grandmother had gone there. And she was really proud of the little things I'd won, and she said to me, "Ken, I finally got my scholar." And about a year later, I was in front of my mom again, and things were a little different because I'd started drinking. I was now behind the counter at the Duwiener Schnitzel, and I was working there full-time. I had dropped out of high school with a 0.8 GPA, and my mom was there because I hadn't been home the night before. And she was standing there and trying not to cry, and she had that look of heartbreak and bafflement on her face. And she said to me, "I don't understand what has happened to you. You used to be so active." And she meant in our parish. And I said the things that we say when we're defending our right to drink. I didn't know that's what I was doing. I just know that alcohol fixes something in me that I need fixing, and I'm willing to pay a high price to have that fixing done, including breaking my mother's heart. And I said to her, "You know, get out of here. Leave me alone. You don't care." Just any of those things that you say to just make you go away. And I had taken my first geographic sometime before that. It seemed like my friends could just party on the weekends and end up back in high school. And I thought, you know, it must be Santa Cruz. It's this party town. If I go somewhere where I don't know anybody, then I'll go to school every day. And so that was my plan-ish. And I had an older sister. She's sober now, but at the time was not. She's 6 years older than me. She was I guess, 18 or 19 at the time. A single mom. My nephew was about 8 months old then. And she was over in Honolulu raising this baby and living on welfare and drinking. And so I moved in with her. That was going to be the thing that was going to fix it. And off I went to Honolulu, and I enrolled in a high school. But guess what? It seemed like the same people that were at Santa Cruz High were at Kaiser High in Honolulu, and I'm off and running again, right? And I do know that I went at least the first day to every class because I had an escort that day taking me from class to class. But after that, you know, and we ended up losing our apartment, and we were homeless for a while. I don't know how, not super long, a matter of weeks maybe, and we stayed on friends' couches and stuff. But I do remember that nobody was ever happy to see us coming, right? These two teenage girls and a baby and some food stamps, you know, and a bus pass. And you know, now I'm not going to school now. I don't even know where I'm sleeping that night. And it just, that was not the solution for sure. And I got drunk and pregnant, and I terminated that pregnancy. And I'm not here to moralize about that for anyone but me. But it had been maybe 9 months or a year before that I'd been confirmed in the Catholic Church and that faith that mattered to me. And that was a line I wasn't going to cross and a principle I wasn't going to break. And early into my drinking, I'm crossing those lines and I'm breaking those principles. And I'm a bad girl and I've got secrets. And, you know, what do? You drink more, right? And, but I figured out the problem. The problem was Honolulu. And if I had never gone there, none of that would have happened. So I'll get back to Santa Cruz. Now the problem and solution places have switched, right? And back I went, and that might have been what should have been my senior year. I'm not too sure. I know I went to 3 or 4 different high schools. I ended up trying to go back in my senior year, and I made it to, like, Halloween, I think. But I got the Julia Schnitzel job, and, you know, I didn't know when I took that job I was going to work for the next 17 years in restaurants. And the first 11 years of my sobriety, nothing wrong with doing that kind of work. I was never happy doing it, though. It was going to be one of those temporary things until my real life started. And I met a guy around this time from the other side of town, and he, you know, my dates were starting to say things like, "You smell like a brewery," and my mom says, "Can't come over anymore. If you've been drinking, it's only 9 a.m. and what are those slash marks on your wrist?" And you can't say those things to me. And this guy, you know, he woke up with the shakes like I did. We could fill in each other's blackouts. And our first date, if you could call it that, was a double date. My best friend, Pam, she worked at Juana Schnitzel too, and I, and these two guys, and both of those guys are dead. Neither of them made it to 50. The man who was to become my boyfriend by the time we were 19, he started going to the penitentiary and was never able to, he had a D number and never was able to get off parole, and he just wore out and died. And the other guy died in custody in my home county. And when I got sober in 1985, my best friend Pam was strung out living in a pickup truck and showering at UCSC. And I have got to spend the last 30, I think back on that night and those four teenagers, and I get to sit here with you and Visalia tonight and how incredibly blessed I am. And anyway, so, you know, I'm dating this guy, and I bought a car around this time, but typically, like everything else in my life, right, it's ready, fire, aim. I have no driver's license, no registration, no insurance. In fact, I didn't even know how to drive. I bought the car first, and, you know, found it in the newspaper, and the problem, well, that, I mean, I was never sober, and it required a lot of motor skills because it was an older car, and it had not only, you know, a stick shift and an overdrive, it had a clutch. I mean, that is just like way too many things. And I didn't, you know, things like driver's license and insurance, that all came in sobriety. And I got to tell you, you know, I've gotten some big things in my life, you know, gotten an education, owned a home, marriage. But I, you know, in the living room is my purse with my license to drive a car. It has my current address on it. It's my photo. I have an insurance card in that wallet, too, that protects me and you. And I have tags on my plates. My car's parked out front, and I've got tags on those plates. And I bought those tags with money that I earned. I did not take a straight-edge razor blade and scrape those tags off anybody else's plates. Those are my tags. And I thought that freedom was in getting on an airplane, black eyes, sunglasses, you know, one-way ticket. I'm one of those Santa Cruz hair flippers. I used to have that long hair, and, you know, I'm out of here. And Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that actually, you know, that I thought that's what freedom was, and actually Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that, you know, freedom is in staying put, in being like what my old sponsor Clancy used to say, being where you say you're going to be when you say you're going to be there, and doing what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. That doesn't look like freedom. That looks like stricture. It looks like responsibility. I don't want any part of it. And that's why I've got, you know, a sponsor and a home group and regular meetings and commitments, because those things teach me those lessons. Anyway, I bought the car, and then the car, you could just kind of became like this metaphor for my drinking. You know, things started to happen to it, right? There was an electrical fire over on the passenger side, and big chunks of the carpet would come up, and I lost the handle for the window, so I'd keep a book of matches there to keep the window up. But then, you know, you need the matches, and so the window would clunk down. And I remember the day that the window clunked down and shattered, and I just thought, oh, thank God. It's like one less thing to figure out. You know, you just keep lowering the bar, right? And, you know, it's cold and foggy and rainy in Santa Cruz in the winter, and but hey, and the something, I don't know, like my foot would burn because like this heat would come out, and I'd have to like pull my foot off the clutch a lot, and a choke. That's the thing, it had a choke, that other complicated thing. And the brake lights went out, and eventually so did the brakes. So hey, and I had this whole routine of downshifting and pumping the brakes and using the emergency brake and putting my foot out the door. And it is no wonder that we were so exhausted. Justin, when you said 2 days before Christmas, you know, I just got that image, right, of this young man dying from alcoholism 2 days before Christmas. And his best plan is to sell us stuff and go live on the streets. Like, only that is such an alcoholic plan, right? And thank God that your uncle and Grace intervened, so that, you know, you could be here to tell us that tale tonight. And, you know, I love our stories. I think they're so important, because when I'm listening to a story, if I think I'm in for a lecture, you know, or theory, you know, I'm ready. My arms are crossed and I'm ready, like with my defense or my rebuttal or my counter argument. When I'm just listening to your story, I'm undefended, right? You're just telling me what happened to you. And if I find myself in that, great. And a story can really sneak up on you, you know. And if you're new, and I think I probably see some gentlemen there that are in the room, I welcome you. And what we have here is not theory, it's experience. This is what happened to me. So the car, there's, you know, I'm having, of course, blackouts and stuff, and just to kind of fast forward, that relationship with that guy got really crazy and violent, and I don't know how to get out of that. I lost a Duane Schnitzel job, by the way. It's possible. I showed up there drunk, and I'd been drinking on the beach all day, and that's never good. And ended up like rolling around with another employee out in the parking lot. And so, I flipped my hair and I went across town to the Gray American Wiener Works and got a job over there. I had, you know, hot dog experience, and that place served beer. And now I'm, you know, stealing from them and loading cases of beer, into my car. And, but I'm, you know, I don't know how to get away from this guy, and just, you know, and people are starting to die around me. I don't know if men feel that way, but I think women, I had that sense of like, if I don't leave here. I'm going to die here. And just, you know, I had a pretty bad week. I've been beaten up by this guy and was trying to get out of that situation, you know, just going to figure it out all on my own, right, not tell anybody. And I came to one afternoon-ish morning, it was actually, and that weight was on my chest, and I, you know, wasn't sure. I knew, you know, trying to figure out what had happened in a blackout. I thought it had something to do with my car. The car was in my mom's garage, not a good sign, because I never put it in her garage. And there were pieces missing off the car, which I've never found. And I called my friends to, because I can't now say, hey, what happened last night? Because even my other drinking friends, I don't want them to know how out of control I am. And I'm hoping maybe they'll mention something, figure out, you know, maybe where I was, what I had done. I don't know. I picked up the morning newspaper. Had I hit anyone or killed anyone? There was nothing in the paper. I borrowed my mom's car, and I was driving around town trying to find those pieces. I never found them. And just within a matter of days, I left that car in her garage. I didn't tell that guy where I was going. One-way ticket, black eye, sunglasses, and I'm back to Honolulu, because now Santa Cruz is the problem, and that's going to be the answer. And I had just turned 18, and drinking age was 18 at that time in the state of Hawaii, and I got a job as a cocktail waitress in Waikiki and started making good money for an 18-year-old high school dropout, and we had four bands a day and two Elvis impersonators, and I got involved with the Elvis's bass players, who was married, and, you know, of course, that was problematic, and you know, I'm just crossing those lines, and by the time I'm 19, I'm on my fourth abortion, and how has that happened? And I assure you, I've never planned on living that way, and now I don't see any way that I can redeem what my life has become. And I know those words and those concepts, redemption, grace, mercy, forgiveness, but those can't possibly be for me because of the way that I'm living and the things that I've done. You can't fix those things. Those are unfixable, and so I'm drinking. And there's a good Catholic word, perdition, spiritual ruin, loss of the soul. We have a longer phrase for it here, pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. But the last few years of my drinking, I was 22 when I got here, I spent in that state of perdition, just lost, just in that state of spiritual ruin. And we know what that feels like. We know what it's like to wander in that darkness. Bill describes it, you know, that in lots of different ways, but one, the chilling vapor of this loneliness settles down. And I can see you out there, but there's like this thick, cold glass between me and the world, and I'm drinking. I ended up living in an apartment that was a lot like the house I grew up in, and I was never going to live that way, right? It was the cinder block building between the Honolulu City bus yard and the Kinau Street freeway off ramp. And the first phone call I made to you was from a payphone or liquor store, because our phone had been cut off, and I easily made rent and utilities and stuff and a couple nights and tips, but that money's going other places. And I couldn't go in that liquor store down on the, and I'd stopped driving after I left Santa Cruz that last time. And what I can see is that my life just got smaller and smaller and smaller until it was the bar that I worked at, the bars that I drank at, and this apartment. And I would just, take taxi cabs with a hat pulled down over or take the bus. And, that the liquor store that was my phone, I made a scene in there. So I would, the next closest liquor store, because I didn't have a car, I would run across that freeway off-ramp and scramble up the embankment. There was a hole in a chain-link fence, and I'd cut through that hole. I can see it so clearly. And it never occurred to me there was anything unusual about that, right? That's where the liquor store is, so what? And I ended up drinking. I worked in Waikiki, and we all used to like go to each other's bars, right? But I couldn't do that anymore because I can't predict my behavior now. I have a huge capacity for alcohol, but I don't know what's going to happen. And I might just have like two or three drinks, and my body's getting drunk very quickly, but my mind is staying sober. And I'm just maybe three, four drinks, and I'm stumbling and falling down, and doormen are putting me in taxi cabs, or I might go into a blackout and get robbed, or I might, you know, my boyfriend might, I might might have a totally different memory of what happened that night. And he'll say, well, where'd you go last night? Like, what do you mean? You know, like, well, you walked out at 2 a.m. and you never came back, and I waited till like 6, and I don't know where I was, and what I was doing. You know, I'd be covered with bruises, and, he came over one afternoon, he started playing in these strip clubs. So that's where I spent the last year or so of my junket. I can't go to the nice nightclubs anymore. You might want me to do something like dance or have a conversation. And I'm not there for that reason. And so I could go to those strip bars. They're open till 4 a.m. They reopen at 6 a.m. I could look at the women on stage. No one's going to, you know, the expectations are very low. And I could drink. And that's what I did. And, he came over one afternoon, this boyfriend of mine, and I had some stitches on my ankle because stuff happens when you're out there. And it was, and he said, you know, I was kind of stumbling around, half drunk, half hungover. He said, look at your ankle. And it was covered with fleas where the stitches were. And I always tell that story when I share, just in case I think there's any glamour left in a cocktail for me. I want to keep that image really fresh in my mind. And that is the 22-year-old, 84-pound woman who came to you in 1985, and you have given her a whole new life consistently for 35 years. You have been in my corner. And that day came for me when just nothing was working. You know, I'm, you know, at this point now, hearing voices and things crawling on my skin and bobbing the liver bile and all that stuff that happens to us in end-stage alcoholism is happening to me. And this one afternoon, I just couldn't get that balance, right? And I had a bottle of vodka in the freezer. I'm working on that, and I'm vomiting liver bile. I'm trying to keep that down. And the racing brain, my head would just all day long say, normal people don't do this, normal people don't do this. And I started to pray that day. I believe that's the difference between that, you know, day and the others. I mean, one, I had come to the limits of my own resources. I couldn't figure it out anymore. And I started to pray. I had the rosary in one hand, vodka in the other. And I believe that, you know, that prayer led me to the payphone at the liquor store. I really didn't have anybody in my life. I couldn't call my married boyfriend, obviously. I called my boss, who was a drinking buddy. And he came over and he took a look at me and he said, you know, I was sick and shaking. He said, you need a drink. Let's go find a bar. It's probably like, I don't know, 10 or 11 in the morning. I don't know. And, I said to him, no, take me to the hospital. Those are the words that came out of my mouth. I don't really know where they came from, but that's what I said. And that's what he did. I saw a nurse before I saw a doctor. And I said to her, I can probably stop the cocaine, but I can't stop drinking. And my life has never been the same. An admission of complete defeat. I said that out loud to another human being. I can't stop drinking. And I felt something. I didn't know about the first step, but I had just taken it. She said to me, "Boy, my boyfriend's an alcoholic and he goes to AA." And I remember thinking, like, oh, you know, it's not that bad. You know, hang on. You know, let's not go to the extreme. And then I saw a doctor, and didn't really, in my case, matter what I thought after that moment, because I said that unsayable thing. I can't stop drinking. The doctor, I wanted some sympathy and some volume. I didn't get those things. He said, you're an alcoholic and I can't help you. And here's some phone numbers, good luck and goodbye, and he sent me on my way. And at the time I thought, wow, how uncaring. Whether he cared or not was inconsequential. He didn't have my answers. You have my answers. And I'm glad that he didn't pretend to have my answers. You know, I mean, they checked my vitals and like that, right? And I believe that those phone numbers were at treatment centers. It's pretty blurry, but I remember going to the payphone at the liquor store. And I, calling a place, and I think I called a few places, but I remember a woman saying, we don't have a bed, but we go to this place tonight. And it turned out to be an AA meeting at the Salvation Army Detox on the Poly Highway. And I don't think I knew what I was going to. I don't think she said it was an AA meeting. I don't remember that. I just got somebody to give me a ride. She said, go to this place tonight. And I went. Now, why would I do that, right? Some random voice on the other end of a payphone. There's only one time that you can, when you're in a state of complete surrender. Right? And I just have given up. And then grace can come in. And I walked into that meeting, and I didn't come here and feel like I was home and feel totally comfortable or anything, but I don't know how else to describe it except that I knew I had stepped into the light. One day I was living in this world of, like, darkness and despair, and I had stepped into this light that's Alcoholics Anonymous. And as cynical and as broken as I was when I got here, I believed you. There was an authenticity, right? A friend of mine says, like, how AA always looks so dumb, like on TV and the movies. Like, they can script it correctly, but what can't be recreated is what's moving through the room, the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And I believed you. I looked right in your eyes, and, there was a message of depth and weight for sure. I knew you suffered what I suffered from, and you seemed to be free men and women, and I kept coming. And I got a sponsor and a home group and began, working the steps. And, I didn't have any trouble with the first step. Step two, it was clear I was being worse. And obviously, as the years go on, those are revisited and you take them more in depth and they're woven into your life. But in those early days, and it was clear that I was being restored to sanity because I wasn't drinking. I couldn't believe it. And as far as I was from God, it was obvious, undeniable that I was living in a state of grace because the obsession was lifted. You know, in Bill's story, and Clint used to talk about this, Clint Hodges, that Bill talks about how God comes to most men slowly, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. And I used to think, man, wouldn't that be great if my room lit up with a big white light like Bill's did? And I have to remember on September 24th, 1985, I could not drink, right? And the next day, I did not pick up a drink. And God's impact to me was sudden and profound. What a remarkable, astounding thing. And so I could start to find my way back to finding a power that was going to enable me to enable the sufferer to live comfortable and usefully whole. And I did that. You know, I was a little afraid of step three. I have a Catholic education. I know what that means to turn my will and my life over. I'm going to have to join Mother Teresa's order and clean the wounds of lepers. And turns out God reserves those jobs for the more spiritually fit. I'll tell you what, everything that I thought that A was going to take from me, that A has given to me. And all the there's nothing to fear here. There's nothing at all to fear here. I did that first inventory and started to get a little more comfortable in my skin. And I knew how important that inventory, I didn't want to do it, of course. But I knew, Bill, again, he talks about we can't live with those tormenting ghosts of yesterday. That I would have to find a way to live comfortably in my skin or I would drink again. And you seem to find that comfort, obviously, through the steps in particular, through that inventory, right? Can't live alone with this tormenting ghost of yesterday. And I shared that inventory, and I got a little bit more free. And when I had about 3 years of sobriety, I moved to Los Angeles. I got accepted to study with this acting teacher. I thought that's what I wanted to do, and I moved, and the old timers in Honolulu said, I don't know where to put this water bottle. It's a huge fellowship in Southern California. We suggest that you get a home group and a sponsor right away and some regular meetings. And I didn't do that. And I hope that this is a cautionary tale for anybody out there. Now, I didn't willfully say I'm not going to do that. And this is why I don't mess with it today, because I know I have, I've got a forgetter, right? And that I forgot very quickly to put A first, and I forgot that I was supposed to listen for the similarities and not the differences. And now I'm going to meetings in LA, and they do it differently than in Honolulu, and the more that I'm comparing how they're different, the space between you and I is getting wider and wider, and I'm getting closer and closer to that door, and I don't even know it's happening. Alcoholism is subtle foe, right? Long story short, I was sponsorless for about a year and a half, was just going to meetings when the heat was on, ended up hooking up with some old friends in Santa Cruz, was going up there a lot, met a heroin dealer that I met in a park or dating him, was receiving stolen property from him and taking his calls from the county jail, and I'm coming up on 5 years of sobriety, and that's about as far out. And I hate to tell you this, you know, chapter, but it's what I did. It's my experience. And that's as far out to the edge as I ever care to take it. And I knew I was in a lot of trouble. And it just happened a little at a time, right? And then it was, I was going to be five, and I kind of took stock, and things were not good. I was waitressing with this woman, Mary Ann King. Some of you may know Mary Ann. She's a proud member of the class of 1969, and we were waitresses together, and I knew she was an active member of an active home group. And I asked her, we met for coffee or dinner or something. I just told her what my life looked like and that I was in trouble. And, she didn't say you're a disgrace to AA and you have to do these 10,000 things. That came later when I got a sponsor. But she just said, there's a little meeting I go to on Monday nights. Why don't you come? And thank God when Monday night came around, I didn't have a better idea. I didn't think, oh, I've been hasty. Oh, I've overreacted, right? One more time, I've been beaten into a state of reasonableness, and I was willing to try it someone else's way. Because when your life is in the condition that I described, and someone offers that solution, a meeting, and you think, a meeting? That puny, that's all you've got? That's your answer? Did you hear what I said? A meeting? But yes, actually, yes, that is the answer. That was the answer. And all the things that, all the ancillary things that go along with that, right? And I went and sat down next to her at Ohio Street, and with the exception of the last year, and now, you know, of course, we're there on Zoom, but I've been sitting next to Mary Ann at that meeting for the last, you know, 3 decades. And, she suggested I get a sponsor, and so that remains my home group, the Pacific group, and somebody just said, ask her. I was in no position to interview, and I asked Karen Garrison, and some of you I'm sure remember Karen, and she absolutely saved my life. And the first thing she said to me was, honey, I expect a lot from the people I sponsor. And I'm so glad she said that, and I'm so glad that you do expect things from me, because I won't do it. I have risen to the level of expectation that you have placed on me, and I am grateful for sponsors and mentors and old-timers who have been willing to do the hard thing, hold the bar a little bit higher than I thought that I could reach, and you know, insist that I consider our common welfare instead of what I want to do, have thought about things that are maybe God's will and not my own, have expected me to, you know, keep commitments and set an example. And, you know, that stuff has really served me well. And Karen, you know, she said, I expected a lot from the people I sponsor with your amount of sobriety. I want you, I think she said 4 or 5 meetings a week, get commitments at those meetings, get an H&I panel, answer phones at central office, get involved with the other women I sponsor. We're going to go through the steps again. You're going to call me 5 days a week, start sponsoring other women. And I remember thinking, like, I have picked the wrong sponsor. Her solutions had nothing to do with my problems. Like, did you hear what they said, right? But, of course, those problems died of neglect. And of course, when I got busy, I got better. And she knew that stuff was going to get me in the middle of the room. I was so close. I had 1 foot out the door. And it was going to put a foundation under me and a fellowship around me. 2 things that remain around me and that I stand on today. I have seen AA from the fringes, and I have seen it from the middle, and the views are entirely different. And my experience has borne out that my life works when I'm in the middle of you, period. That inventory I did with Karen, one of the things on that was I was ashamed of the fact that I only had an 8th grade education, and I'm still waiting tables, and I felt really stuck. But now, you know, I'm in AA, and I'm hearing all these speakers like Clint Hodges that I mentioned. You know, I was living in a garage, and now I'm a lawyer, and like, My God, that's fantastic. If I sit in enough meetings, I'll be a lawyer too one day. And Karen said, no, honey, God only does for us what we can't do for ourselves. And why don't you get your high school diploma, take the GED exam? And I thought, that is ridiculous. I mean, one, I know I can't pass. And two, GED, how about a PhD? Right? It's either I'm too good for it or not good enough. There's no middle ground, right? But that's why I have a sponsor and why, and thank God for the gift of surrender and being willing to try it somebody else's way. Because I didn't even know that that mattered to me until I had the letter in my hand from the state of California at 28 years old saying, congratulations, you're a high school graduate. Because it's easier for me to be contemptuous of something and act like I don't care than possibly try and fail. And the other big gift of that experience is that I learned that the action does not care how contemptuous you are of it. It just matters that you take it. I thought that was stupid and lame and had no bearing on my life, but I was willing to do it. And I remember Clint telling me when I said, hey, I took the GED exam and I hadn't gotten the results yet. And he said, that's going to do something for you. And I remember thinking like, oh, what's he talking about? But here's the thing. You have to take, that's what a leap of faith looks like, right? I want to know the results before I do it. I want the good feeling before I even do it, right? I have to do it. And I have this much perspective on my case. And that's why I have to have a sponsor. She could see in that inventory that that was something that warranted going back and cleaning up. And I started going to community college and it was my third one because I'm a great starter but AA taught me how to finish and, taking a class at a time. And I was there for a few years and eventually a plan developed. I wanted to transfer to UCLA and major in English Lit, but I couldn't meet the math requirement. And I was there for about an extra year trying and failing. Introduction to Algebra 3 times, Computational Skills 2 times, Tutoring, Math Anxiety Tapes. But I learned here about footwork, and I eventually was tested for a learning disability and was told I had a severe learning disability in math and that I was not going to have a university education. I should consider a vocational school or a non-accredited school. And I've since learned as an educator today that one no means very little. It just means somebody was misinformed. No big deal. And that's why I have a sponsor, because I want to take that no and use it to burn my life to the ground, right? And she said, honey, just keep knocking on doors and keep trying. And I did that. And it's been a long time now. In June of 97, I put on a cap and gown for the first time in my life. I was 33 years old, 11 years sober. And I graduated from UCLA. I got to give the commencement address at that graduation. My mom had her scholar back. She got to sit in the VIP section. It was a long wait from eighth grade, but she took it. And another member of my home group also graduated that day. And we had a little party at the Ohio Avenue Meeting Hall. And then we went up to campus. And my plan was to teach for a year and go to graduate school. And I kind of floundered for a bit. And then I had a sponsorship change, and I was kind of struggling and not really knowing, like what the next step was going to be. And I was, praying, God, where should I serve? What would you have me do? And a friend of mine in my home group, Lisa, was saying, we really need teachers, special ed, middle school, LA Unified and Gardena. And I'm like, no special ed, no middle school, no LA Unified. Where's Gardena? Like none of the above. And then I'm over here, God, where should I serve? What would you have me do? And I didn't know that God did such a good impression on my friend Lisa. And I mentioned that job to my sponsor, Marion. And she said, as the mother of a former special ed student, I think you could really be of service there. And I think in your heart that's where you're supposed to be. And the minute she said that, I did know that's where I was supposed to be, but that's not the answer I wanted, right? When I'm praying for the fear to be removed, what I mean is make me not afraid. Maybe like an angel with a golden scroll can come down with lots of glittery writing saying this is the path that will be easy and fluffy, I don't mean like send me to 162nd Normandy to make me walk through the fear, right, with some big kid in my face saying, oh, pimp slap you be. Like, that can't be it. Surely that is not. God's will's got to be like less of a commute, and there'll be books and soap and paper towels in the bathroom. Like, that's not it. But it was it. And never, those gifts in my experience just never look like how you think they're going to look. And I took that job. It was a, you know, definitely a tough environment. I started in February. They'd had a different sub every day. No teacher would stay. But, you know, I know how to take and keep a commitment. And thanks to you. And I taught that year with those kids, and it was, of course, one of the most, satisfying things I've ever done in my life. Hardest and satisfying things. But I have my plan to go to graduate school, and so the next year I went up to Stanford and got a master's in English Lit, and I ended up on the faculty for a while at the community college where my sponsor had sent me to take one class and where my learning disability was diagnosed, and I taught there part-time, and I was so sure that I thought that's what I wanted to do, but I found that my heart was really teaching, especially at middle school. And that meant more school, so that stupid GED turned into a bachelor's and a master's and 2 teaching credentials and 1 very tired middle-aged woman and a significant amount of debt. But I have to tell you that many times when I'm in the classroom, I don't want to be anywhere else, and I don't want to be anyone else. I feel comfortably and usefully whole. And for the chronically restless, irritable, and discontent, that is not a bad deal, right? And I certainly have had my moments with it, many of them. And I, and those pregnancies that I terminated that I thought I could never make that right. Now, I've been able to live with that clearly and carry it. And through the sacrament of confession and a retreat through the Catholic Church and the steps, and, you know, I've been able to carry that. But I was about 20 years sober before I realized, working with special ed, they're very unwanted kids. And I work with a lot of kids in the system. The foster families don't want them. They're in group homes. Teachers don't want them in their classrooms. Judges don't want them in their courtrooms. And working with those unwanted kids has been a way for me to balance those scales in a totally unexpected way. And, man, I could have missed it. Right? If I would have said to Marion, okay, I'll teach, but not there, not that. If I would have put conditions on that direction, I would have missed it. And I, you know, surrender and remaining teachable, and I'm sure there's lots of things that I have missed, but a lot of gifts have come to me when I've been able to surrender and try it someone else's way. I think that, you know, when I'm surrendered and someone else is willing to serve, that God can come in that place in the middle. And if I get into God's spot, I'm going to miss it. I was, checking the time. I was single all of my life and thought I would always stay that way. I had a lot of old ideas about marriage, seeing what it did to my mother, being married to an alcoholic, and I just had a very defended heart. And you had some long-term relationships, but, you know, hadn't for a while, and just kind of thought that wasn't going to be for me. And then I met Mike. Mike got sober at 53. He walked off of Skid Row and into the Midnight Mission and started working for Clancy the next day. And he had done close to 30 years in the penitentiary. And a guy like that, having done that much time and, you know, drinking and using for that long and been in and out of that many programs, should not have gotten sober, but that happened. And a woman like me, large and in charge, stay away, should not have fallen head over heels, out loud, heart on my sleeve, in love with this man. But that happened too. Those two things happened. And we were just astounded that in middle age, you know, that this, I mean, it was like, as he just shattered all that glass around my heart. He lit up a room in my heart I didn't even know was there. And we just couldn't believe it. We would just look at each other like, because it was just as if we'd been like apart for lifetimes, and we just came home to one another, and we just couldn't believe it, how lucky we were, and we bought a house, you know. And I'd say, like, if somebody would have told you 9 years ago when you were standing at 6 in San Pedro that, you know, in 9 years you'll be engaged to a school teacher and own a house in Pasadena, and then he would say, I wouldn't have believed it. And I mean, he was out there long and hard. His Social Security statement came a while ago. There were 32 years of zeros. So that, you know, that doesn't tell you. I wish he was here to tell you his story, because what an amazing story it was. It is. But we bought a house. We got engaged in 2015, and we bought a house. And the house just, I can see how God was working and all of that. We weren't looking. It came up. We saw it in the paper, and within a month of moving into the house, it was clear that he was sick. And that started this odyssey of trying to, you know, he had terrible health insurance and getting, you know, figuring out what was going on. And eventually, I think I had taken a day off work and for a training. I said, let's just go to this emergency room. They accept your insurance. And we did that. And there were scans, and it wasn't good. And, you know, clearly there were masses. And we were staying in that hospital for a week, and we're still trying to, you know, figure out what was going on. And we came home with, you know, medical records and waiting for results and stuff. And our house was full of bed bugs. We had to pack up everything and tent the houses. There's a little get back house, tent those, and move into a hotel. A member of our home group gave us a bunch of points so we could move into a hotel for a week. And I'm carrying around this bag of medical records, and we're making phone calls and trying to teach. And the day we got back in the house, we found out we got approved to go to City of Hope, which is a, you know, world-renowned cancer hospital 10 miles down the road. And we thought, oh, you know, okay, great. You know, whew, that was hard. We're back on track, though. You know, we've got a future. Go to City of Hope, whatever it is. They'll solve it. We're back in the house. Great. And you know, went out there with our, like, bag of medical records. And within maybe 5 minutes of that first oncology appointment, and he ended up with 9 doctors there and had the most extraordinary care. Just extraordinary. We were so blessed. But within that very first appointment, they said, you have 6 to 10 months. And we got 10 months. And we felt cheated. You know, we thought, like, why would God invite us to this banquet and then, like, take it away after 3 bites? Like, that is not how this is supposed to go, right? Like, no. I'm the high school dropout that went to Stanford. Like, I can, like, bash these things down. Like, this isn't how it ends. Like, I've had all these obstacles. I can, you know, I can go under them, around them, knock them down. And, you know, liver cancer was not going to yield to me. And it didn't. And, you know, and the serenity prayer is great for things like traffic. But what about stuff that's unacceptable? This was unacceptable. But it was happening, and that sorrow and anguish, especially in the beginning of it, and all the people that are, you know, in AA that are coming up to you and they're looking at you, and you just want to say, like, oh, please don't, please let that look be for somebody else. Please don't, you know, let it not be so. But it was so, and people would say, I don't know how you do it, but you can't not do it. It's happening, right? And it's not the ride we wanted to be on, but it was the car that pulled up. You get in the car. But A works, right? It works in fair weather and foul. I thought sobriety was going to be Snow White's cottage, you know, and the little bluebirds would tie my dressing gown, and I would be a good girl, and my Santa Claus would be my God, and I'd get everything on my list. But you never said that. It doesn't say that anywhere. It says we'll be able to match calamity with serenity. Right? And I don't know, and that I, you know, was able to match it with strategy, but I matched it. We matched it. And we were already engaged. We wanted to get married. And so we had a wedding that we, you know, kind of moved up. I mean, we got married and he was diagnosed in like May, April or May. We got married in July 2nd in Clancy's backyard, and our home group put on a wedding for us. And thank God that we had dropped anchor in a home group deep and wide so that we weren't just out there, right? Like alone with this, because liver can't, and then everything just started happening. Just this avalanche of, you know, diabetes and COPD and emphysema, and it, like, you know, spread, of course, to the lungs. And I had no idea that so many things could go wrong with one human body. And watching him suffer, and man, did he suffer. And he would have been a much better... He was like 10 times, 100 times the person I am. Definitely. But love makes allowances. And I, you know, I have regret and I have remorse. I went to a grief group for a couple of years and went through the steps again. And... you know, that's part of the package too, of the grief is, you know, what if we would have done this and why did I say that and et cetera. And, but you know, we got married, we showed up and there was a wedding there. And I have to tell you that planning to be a bride and a widow at the same time was quite a walk, right? Like we're in the hospital and I'm like looking for a dress on the internet and then like signing the papers to have his body picked up when it was, you know, 'cause he wanted to die at home. And, and for 269 days, it's time for me to stop. I was Mike's wife. That's how long we were married. And, you know, now here I am. And, you know, growing up on the Monterey Bay, it's foggy, right? Even in the summer, used to be. And, you know, that fog just sits out there and then the sun goes down, it kind of rolls in. And towards the end of Mike's life, there was this, I felt like that. What is this fog out on the edges of my life? And it was his imminent death, but it was something else. And I didn't even know how lonely I was until he took that away. Like, oh, that's what that was. It was the absence that I noticed, right? And one day I realized, like, oh, that's what that fogginess is. It's that loneliness that's just going to roll right in. And, you know, because this is a story, it'd be nice to give you a happy ending and say, but no, that's not what it was. No, it's here. And you make, you know, and so you make friends with it, right? You invite it in, like everything else. You know, good morning, heartache, sit down. And, you know, grief, it was a very heart-opening experience, and I wouldn't have missed it, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. For the 269 days that I was his wife, it was worth it. Make no mistake. I would trade all the gifts of the grief, the dimensions that it's given to my life for Mike, but I don't get that option, right? And I still don't have any bad news about my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Here I am, you know, and still navigating it, and it's my lifelong companion. It's this huge hole, and then your life grows around it. And I'm going to do that right here in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to thank you guys. That was a lot of talking. For being so present with me tonight. I can feel you all the way down here and taking this ride with me. I want to thank you for being with me here tonight, for all the days that have led up to this one or all the days to come. And if you're new, you just stay right here. It's a good life. Thank you.